From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! White-collar crime costs the country more in money and lives than street crime, yet it is hardly mentioned in political campaigns. We'll talk about corporate responsibility and the tyranny of the bottom line. And a gun control advocate takes us on a tour of a gun show where militia materials and racist propaganda proliferate.
It's a belief amongst many of these folks that the UN is the vehicle by which worldwide gun control will be enacted.
That and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now!, Public Broadcasting's only daily election show. I'm Amy Goodman. Senate Majority Leader Robert Dole does California today in naming a veteran California political strategist as a top advisor. Senator Dole is serving notice that he won't concede the state to President Clinton, who's making California the anchor of his reelection strategy. Ken Kachigian, designated yesterday as Dole's national senior advisor, has helped deliver California for a long line of presidential and gubernatorial candidates. Clinton holds a 20-point lead in the polls in California, which carries one-fifth of the electoral votes needed to win the presidency. Dole was making his first visit to California today since he began campaigning for the White House full-time. He doesn't have a campaign office in the state yet, and his itinerary is still being put together. At least it was being put together late yesterday. And yesterday, Dole did take his presidential campaign to a key battleground state, New Jersey. He used Memorial Day's trip there to honor military veterans and to underscore the need for U.S. military might. Polls show Dole trailing Clinton in New Jersey, which with 15 electoral votes is considered crucial to the GOP's chances this fall. New Jersey has always been a battleground state, said Congressman Dick Zimmer, Republican of New Jersey, who is running for the Senate against fellow Congressman Democrat Robert Torricelli. It's a hotly contested race, and it's a race over the open seat that is being opened by the retiring Bill Bradley. Clinton's trip is planned for New Jersey next week. It will be his fourth trip to the state. Yesterday was Dole's first. And there are two primaries that are taking place today, one in Idaho and one in Kentucky. In Idaho, there are 23 Republican delegates up for grabs. Idaho's 24 Democratic delegates were chosen in March caucuses. In Kentucky, there are 26 Republican delegates, Democratic delegates 61. Clinton is likely to win all the delegates. His only opponent, Lyndon LaRouche, has not reached the 15% threshold to qualify for delegates in any state. And just some facts and figures on Idaho and Kentucky. Idaho has a population of 1.1 million. It's got 626,000 registered voters, and there's no party registration there. In 1992, 42% of the vote went to Bush, 28% to Clinton, 27% to Perot. The poverty rate is 12%, and the median household income is $25,000. In Kentucky, a population of 3.6 million, 65% Democrat, 30% Republican. Median household income, $23,000. Poverty rate, 18.5%. In 92, 45% of the voters voted for Clinton, 41% Bush, 14% for Perot. In other election news, the co-chairwoman of President Clinton's reelection campaign in Washington state has resigned because of Clinton's decision to support a Republican bill that would deny recognition of gay marriages. Clinton announced his support last week for what Republicans call the Defense of Marriage Act, even though Congress has taken no action on the bill, and there's a good chance it will never pass. The woman who was the one who resigned from the campaign is named Tina Pudlowski. She is a lesbian, said she was asked nearly two months ago to lead Clinton's campaign in the state, a job which primarily involves money and fundraising. This is her first year on the city council in Washington state after resigning as a manager of Microsoft Corporation to enter politics. And we have some international news, international election news. Likud party leader Benjamin Netanyahu says that if elected prime minister of Israel tomorrow, He will refuse to discuss the future of Jerusalem with Palestinians, despite an Israeli agreement to do so. And this news from Burma. Burma's military rulers launched a personal attack today on democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi as her National League for Democracy wound up a three-day Congress against the backdrop of mass detentions. The ruling military body, the State Law and Order Restoration Council, known as SLORC, attacked Suu Kyi and the NLD and the official media after holding a massive public rally yesterday to denounce destruction forces in Burma. Sources in Rangoon said the government was expected to stage another rally today. Pro-democracy activists here in the U.S. are calling on the Clinton administration and Congress to impose economic sanctions against the Burmese regime. This would prevent corporations like Unocal and PepsiCo from doing business in Burma. And closer to home, but speaking about corporations, this happened in New Haven yesterday. Shouting into bullhorns and carrying signs that read, "Stop Yale's Corporate Greed," union protesters disrupted Yale's commencement with a rally just outside campus. The Reverend Jesse Jackson told about 3,500 protesters, students leave with high IQs and Yale degrees, but without learning to respect janitors and taxi drivers. The Yale unions, which have been without a contract since February 7th, represent 3,700 clerical, maintenance, dining hall, and custodial workers. Yale wants more flexibility to hire outside workers. Unions fear that this will erode their job security. And you're listening to Democracy Now! As we move into our first segment of the news of Democracy Now!, and we are talking today about corporate responsibility. Earlier this month, President Clinton hosted a roundtable on corporate responsibility with business and a few labor leaders, academics, and the press. But what was accomplished more than a little nice chat about good corporate citizenship, worker retraining, and family-friendly workplaces, and possibly a few more corporate campaign contributions for Clinton's campaign coffers? The summit didn't challenge the nature of corporate greed, nor the vast environmental and labor abuses that persist in U.S. workplaces. We're joined by two people right now to talk about that summit, the people that were there, and also the overall issue of corporate responsibility. We're joined by Ralph Estes, professor of business at American University, and author of Tyranny of the Bottom Line, Why Corporations Make Good People Do Bad Things. We're also joined in our Washington studio by Russell McIver, who is editor of the Corporate Crime Reporter. Why don't we begin with Professor Estes? You were at the Corporate Responsibility Roundtable. Can you tell us what happened there?
It was basically a feel-good session, parading several executives of companies that were characterized as responsible to describe what they had done that was good. And some of it was good. I don't want to take away from that. Some of the stories about no layoff policies were very good models for other companies to follow, particularly companies like AT&T. But the problem, as I'm sure my fellow guest will emphasize this morning, is that when you look at one good thing a corporation does, you omit so much of the full picture. And that's why I often say that there's no such thing as a really good corporation. There's a corporation that maybe does something good in one dimension, but if you look at the other dimensions, you may find a criminal record or a terrible record with respect to employees or pollution. So what the White House did with this conference was a little bit of a good thing. It won't last, I'm sure. It will serve only during the political season. And in the long run, unfortunately, it won't make a dent in the abuses that are coming out of the corporate system.
At the end of the day, when you were there, did President Clinton extract any kind of promises from these corporations, even if voluntary?
No, and at the beginning of the day, if you asked me if he was likely to do that, I would have said I'm certain he will not. And the reason he would not is that because, not to put too cynical a cast on it, but this was essentially a political session. This was a session to give the president an opportunity to pick up on some of the concern that Patrick Buchanan identified in New Hampshire and even Bob Dole followed up with later, and to say that, yes, we too in the White House and in the Democratic Party care about workers and care about people and care about the effects that corporations are having on them. But at the same time, President Clinton was trying to walk a tightrope that he's walked before, and that is keep the CEOs happy and keep the corporate contributions and the campaign contributions flowing in to the campaign. And so I think it's very unlikely that during this campaign you will see any kind of real challenge from the president or from the presidential campaign or any kind of real criticism of corporate America, some of which would be very warranted if it would be forthcoming.
Ralph Estes, in just a minute, I want to talk with you about the op-ed piece you had in the Washington Post this last weekend. But I want to turn to Russell McIver, whose last corporate crime reporter, published out of Washington Weekly, talked about the corporate executives that were gathered at this corporate responsibility roundtable. Russell, can you tell us who they were?
Yes, Amy, we did a little survey of the approximately 110 CEOs of companies who attended the conference, and we found out that 17% of them were CEOs of companies with criminal records, some of them pretty serious. For example, one of the CEOs, Ralph Larson, who's CEO of Johnson & Johnson, participated with the president on one of the two panels and spoke of the company's model safety and health program. What was not mentioned was the fact that in January 95, Johnson & Johnson's Ortho Pharmaceutical Unit, which is wholly owned subsidiary, pled guilty to 10 counts of obstruction of justice and destruction of documents. Also, another example, and these are some very serious crimes, another example is George David, who's CEO of United Technologies, attended. United Technologies is a recidivist corporate criminal. In May 1991, they pled guilty to six felony pollution counts and were fined $3 million for illegal disposal of hazardous waste in Connecticut. And in October 92, United Technologies pled guilty to four felony defense procurement fraud counts and were fined $2 million. Now,
can you explain recidivist, Russell?
Yeah, that's a criminal that's a repeat offender. Now, the problem, and of course, because corporate crime is crime without shame, we allow three strikes, you're out, which applies to individuals, doesn't apply to corporations. And in fact, we allow recidivist companies like General Electric to own major broadcasting units like NBC, and there's no real challenge. But the point that we raised in Corporate Crime Reporter, and I'd like to raise today, is that had there been a conference at the White House of individual citizenship, and 100 individual, energetic, dedicated citizens were invited to the White House, and it turned out that 17% of these citizens had felony criminal records, there would be a huge uproar. Clinton would you know, pundits would say that he had lost his political bearings, that he was soft on crime, you know, his poll numbers would go down and so forth. But because we don't in this country take corporate crime seriously, this wasn't even addressed. And the event, which I also attended, was stage managed as sort of a Hollywood event. The morning sessions, which was breakfast with all of these company executives, including the criminal company executives, there was no press allowed there. And while press was allowed at the Georgetown University roundtable, they were not allowed to ask questions. They were just brought in like sheep, and they left without asking questions.
Russell McIver, do you think even if the press was allowed to ask questions that they would raise these kinds of issues, talking about the criminal records of these corporations?
Well, you know, this is information that the press has reported on, and this is publicly available information. And I think the White House was aware that there was a problem because they refused to release the list of attendees until after the president took the stage. So we had been looking for the list for a week. I mean, this we had reported on this conference weeks before it happened, and the White House refused to release the list. So I think they realized there was a problem.
Did you talk to the White House?
Yes. I was speaking to Brenda Anders at the White House throughout for the whole month up until the conference, and she absolutely refused to release the list. She had the list. She refused to release it. And then after we did our survey, when I asked her about it, she said, well, the Treasury Department and the Labor Department had vetted the names of the executives, but she wasn't sure whether the issue of their crimes had come up.
Ralph Estes.
Yeah, I was just imagining the kind of ad that the opposition, Senator Dole's campaign, would have on television this week. If the president had had a conference of 100 so-called stellar individuals and it turned out that 17% of them were criminals, can we expect this week then for the Dole campaign to run television ads pointing out that the White House has had a conference with 17% of the honored participants being convicted criminals. We don't think they will. I don't think they will. And the reason I don't think they will is because it's six of one, half a dozen of the other. Both sides, both of the major parties, are pretty much in bed with corporate America. They rely on that source for major campaign contributions. And as long as that's the situation in this country, we're not going to get any real reform in the corporate system.
In fact, Senator Dole is making crime his major issue this week, you know, as he did foreign policy a few weeks ago, et cetera. Crime is the issue this week. Ralph Estes, do you think that the CEOs of these corporations, of corporations like Northrop Grumman and TRW and others that were there, do you think they are criminals?
Oh, I have to pause and take a long breath before I answer yes. I'm looking here now at the corporate crime reporter for this week that Russell's just put out. And it reads that United Technologies pled guilty to six felony pollution counts and was fined $3 million for illegal disposal of hazardous wastes at one of its facilities. Now, I don't know, and maybe we can't know, whether anyone died from those activities or not. But we can be absolutely certain that people were seriously at risk from those activities. If I did that, if you did that in your neighborhood, you can almost be certain that the long arm of the law would come crashing down on you, and it wouldn't be three strikes you're out. You'd be out of circulation pretty quickly. But with the corporations, we don't even have three strikes and you're in. You keep on repeating, and there is still no serious penalty. There is no death penalty for the corporate murderer. In fact, I think Russell may have said this before in the Corporate Crime Reporter, if you kill one individual, you're liable to get the electric chair, but if you kill hundreds or thousands through toxic products or dangerous workplaces, then you'll go scot-free.
Russell McIver, you do have facts and figures comparing street crime to white-collar crime. What are they overall as a nation?
Well, you know, Amy, one of the reasons that this isn't taken seriously, because there's a couple serious myths that that are out there. One is that street crime is more serious than corporate crime. In fact, criminologists who studied this issue find just the opposite. Corporate crime and violence inflicts far more damage on society than all street crime combined. For example, just in terms of white-collar fraud, the FBI says that the fraud every year, in terms of burglary and robbery every year, the street equivalent of fraud, costs the nation about $4 billion a year. But one estimate on white-collar fraud, that is fraud generally committed by doctors, lawyers, accountants, and their corporation, alone costs 50 times as much, or $200 billion a year, $100 billion of that being healthcare fraud, according to the government. The other myth is that corporate crime is not violent crime, but, again, wrong. The FBI puts the street homicide rate at about 24,000 a year. But the Labor Department says that more than twice that number, 56,000 Americans, die every year on the job. Some of those deaths are prosecuted as reckless homicides, or from occupationally induced diseases such as black lung, brown lung, asbestosis, and various other cancers. And that's not including the untold thousands who die every year from defective products and pollution. So there are those myths are believed by most people in society, including reporters. So they say, oh, this is not as serious, and, you know, we won't take it as seriously. But the other problem is that corporate crime, as I mentioned earlier, is crime without shame. So you have the people who scream most about shame and morality, the likes of Bill Bennett, George Will, Newt Gingrich, rarely focus on corporate crime and violence. And the same with TV shows. The focus is primarily street crime. So corporations can defraud governments repeatedly, and three strikes you're out doesn't apply. And George Will can raise the issue of spanking juvenile delinquents, but there's no equivalent of spanking corporate delinquents.
Amy, let me give a personal example on this. They say the personal is political. Russell said that there's a myth in society that corporate crime is not violent the way street crime is. I used to do a fair amount of expert witness work in wrongful death and personal injury cases, and once I testified on the economic loss of a young woman who had died from toxic shock syndrome. Now, this came about through the use of a Playtex superabsorbent tampon that was known to the company to have wicking characteristics that would too frequently result in toxic shock syndrome. The testimony of the husband of this young woman in the courtroom literally brought tears to my eyes and virtually everyone else in the courtroom. She was racked, literally racked with pain for over 24 hours. Her body shook. She was in such extraordinary pain that he was in a absolutely distraught about what to do, and there was nothing he could do because they both knew that she was dying, that she was suffering from something that was incurable. And then she died at the end of the day. It's hard to imagine anything more violent than that crime. And that crime was committed by a corporation, and it was committed with knowledge beforehand of the effects of this product on people, and still they put it out there. They put it out there because they're driven by what in the book I call the tyranny of the bottom line. They're driven not because they're necessarily greedy individuals or malevolent individuals, but because the scorecard that measures their performance doesn't measure the deaths from toxic shock syndrome, and it doesn't measure the harm in the workplace or the harm to the communities. It measures just the effects on the stockholders' profit, and that is what we have to change if we're going to change the extent of these abuses by corporate America.
Ralph Estes, we're going to come back to that in just a minute. Again, Ralph Estes is joining us, who's author of Tyranny of the Bottom Line, Why Corporations Make Good People Do Bad Things. We're also joined by Russell McIver, who puts out the weekly Corporate Crime Reporter based in Washington, D.C. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, and I'm joined by two guests. We're continuing our conversation with Ralph Estes, author of Tyranny of the Bottom Line, Why Corporations Make Good People Do Bad Things, and also Russell McIver, who puts out the Corporate Crime Reporter, and in the last issue put out a list of some of the corporations that were at the Corporate Responsibility Roundtable that President Clinton held at Georgetown just a couple weeks ago. And Russell found that one out of six of the corporate executives who attended the White House Conference on Corporate Citizenship had companies with criminal records. Pretty astounding stuff here, and certainly nothing we read in the mainstream media. Now, Ralph Estes, at the beginning of your book, you talk about a similar case to the one you were just talking about, A.H. Robbins and the Dalkon Shield, and a very angry judge that scolded A.H. Robbins for the kind of pain it inflicted, talking precisely about, well, the title of your book, and that's the tyranny of the bottom line. Do we have many judges like this in this country?
Oh, I'm tempted to give a pontifical kind of answer, but I don't know. I don't know much about the state of the judiciary in the country, but I would be very surprised if there are very many who would take the approach that judge took, because judges come out of the same kind of social and legal system that is characteristic of Congress, and that means that they are not acculturated to treat corporations the way they treat individuals and to treat corporate misbehavior and crime the way they treat that of individuals. So I would expect that there are not very many judges like that, although there ought to be.
In fact, Russell McIver, have corporate executives been found guilty? Has any corporate executive been found guilty of murder because of something his or, I hesitate to say her, there's not many women corporate heads, but how many because of something that they may have done in the workplace?
I'm not sure on corporate executives, but corporations have been indicted and convicted of reckless homicide. And there would have been more criminal prosecution of corporations for reckless homicide, but for the Ford Pinto case in Indiana in 1980, three teenage girls died in a Ford Pinto when it was rear-ended and exploded into flames, and they were burned to death. a Republican prosecutor in Indiana criminally prosecuted the company, Ford Motor Company, for reckless homicide. But due to still unexposed, I believe, shenanigans on behalf of the company, the jury found the company not guilty. But one of the and that sent a message to other prosecutors that these are, you know, if you go up against major American corporations with reckless homicide charges, you're going to have a big fight on your hands. And since homicide charges are generally state prosecutions, you're not going to have a small state prosecutor bring these cases. But one of the points that I wanted to make about this conference, just to get back to the conference real quick, Amy, is that one of the reasons I'm starting to come up with this theory. I'm not there yet on the theory, but crime and shame are linked to the degree that the criminal has a little or no power. So the Clinton and Dole can rant and rave about street criminals as much as they want, because they know there's going to be very little to pay for it. But these big corporations are dumping a lot of money into the Democratic and Republican campaign coffers, and it effectively buys silence from the president and from his challenger. So they're not going to raise this issue because the corporations have the power.
Let me get to, with Ralph Estes, the whole notion that he put forward in this Washington Post op-ed piece called Antidote to Economic Anxiety, Stakeholder Capitalism, the Missing Idea at Clinton's Feel-Good Business Summit. Ralph Estes, what is stakeholder capitalism?
Stakeholder capitalism is management of enterprises for the balanced benefit of all the stakeholders. That's all the parties that make the corporation or the enterprise successful, and all those that are significantly affected by the actions of the enterprise. And so, in essence, that means all of us in the society. Stakeholder capitalism is a term that's been thrown around quite a bit, especially in the political scene in England lately, with Tony Blair using it sort of as a symbol, but he never defines it. So I want to put some flesh and blood behind the concept. Stakeholder capitalism is a more humane kind of capitalism. It's not a departure from capitalism. It's still a free market, free enterprise system, but it's one that holds a corporation accountable to, and management personally accountable to, the effects on all the stakeholders and not just the stockholders. And if we can achieve that, if we can achieve that kind of corporate accountability that we do not now have, then we will have not perfect corporations, but we'll have a substantially improved and substantially more humane corporate and economic system.
What possibility do you think is there of achieving this when you look at the way corporations define politics, you know, give money to campaigns, and so politicians don't raise it?
Well, in the brief time we have, we can't go into this too much, but there's great hope in the recognition that corporations were originally created in history, way back in 1601, 1600, to serve the public interest, not the private interest of stockholders. And this public purpose was perverted only in the last century. So we have to get the American people to understand that we have a claim against the corporation to serve the public purpose, especially since we are the ones who grant the corporation's life through publicly issued charters. Every corporation has to go to a state and ask for a charter. They can't initiate these, they can't create these on their own. So that's the first step. And the second step, then, is to start holding corporations accountable. We're undertaking to do that through the creation of a national stakeholder alliance, an alliance of organizations and individuals that in every forum will demand accountability from corporations for the kinds of crimes and the kinds of harmful effects that they are doing to society and that are described in Russell Muckiver's Corporate Crime Reporter. If we can bring about that kind of accountability through a change scorecard and through a strong citizen-based stakeholder alliance, then we have hope over a number of years of reversing this perversion of corporate purpose.
Russell Muckiver, do you hold out much hope for this?
Well, I think Ralph's work is very important. But to quote John Braithwaite's, one of the world's leading corporate criminologists, he has said that the fundamental problem in societies with rampant corporate crime is the absence of effective processes of societal shaming. The first priority has to be corporate crime shall not be tolerated. And Amy, respect for legal authority, like a fish, rots from the head down, and by cavorting with corporate criminals, the president ensured that the legal system is going to continue to rot. He should have spoken out. He said he didn't want to be negative, but he wouldn't have said that if they're just individual criminals attending at the White House.
Can I get some quick phone numbers? Russell McIver, your corporate crime reporter.
Corporate crime reporter is at 202-429-6928.
That's 202-429-6928. And Ralph Estes, your center.
Contact the Stakeholder Alliance through my email at restes, R-E-S-T-E-S, at american.edu. Phone number of the center is 202-797-0606.
That's 797-0606, 202 area code. I want to thank you both very much for joining us. Ralph Estes, professor of business at American University. His latest book, Tyranny of the Bottom Line, Why Corporations Make Good People Do Bad Things. And Russell McIver, editor of the Corporate Crime Reporter, a weekly out of Washington, D.C. You're listening to Democracy Now! Up next, we take a look at guns and gun control.
What you going to do? Go and give a boy a gun. Now there ain't no place to run to. Ain't no place to run. When he holds it in his hand, he feels mighty, he feels strong. Now there ain't no place to run to. Ain't no place to run. One day he may come back. He pays for what we done. Where you gonna run to? Where you gonna run? But one fine day, all our problems will be solved. So bang, 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 we shoot him down.
And that is Tracy Chapman. Gun control is sure to be a critical issue in the 1996 presidential and congressional elections. Today in New York, 52-year-old nurse Carolyn McCarthy, whose husband was killed by the Long Island Railroad gunman, Colin Ferguson, will announce her candidacy for Congress. A lifelong Republican, McCarthy will run as a Democrat against GOP incumbent Dan Frisa because of his vote to repeal the ban on assault weapons. The gun lobby hasn't won its battle against the Brady Bill, and looking at the NRA's record over the past few years, they haven't exactly gotten a lot of bang for their buck on the national level. But the issue of gun control is also being fought out in state legislatures and lower levels of government across the country. Today in San Francisco, the City Board of Supervisors will meet to debate a gun control law that would place restrictions on pawn shop gun sales, would ban the sale of armor-piercing ammunition in the city, and would require a warning label on guns that says, if you leave a loaded firearm where a child obtains and improperly uses it, you may be fined or sent to prison. Also in California, county officials are considering controlling gun sales at gun shows in their communities. Pacifica reporter Philip Babich takes us on a tour of a recent gun show in the Bay Area.
If you're not used to being around guns, the gun show can be an overwhelming spectacle. About 300 dealer booths are stocked with 9mm handguns, Army surplus rocket and grenade launchers, 50 caliber machine gun ammunition, Chinese SKS military rifles, and AK clips for assault weapons. Andreas Soto, who's with a Bay Area Violence Prevention Center, points out one assault weapon that became well-known to the nation after a 1993 shooting spree in a downtown San Francisco office building.
What's so interesting about this gun here?
This is an Intratec DC-9, 9mm. This is the weapon that was used for the 101 California Street Massacre, the 8 people that were killed in the law offices by Gianluigi Ferri. 239.99, ready to go.
It's clear the gun show promoters aren't happy to see us, a member of the press and a gun control advocate. Soto says he's not surprised by their suspicion, though. Since the Oklahoma City bombing, there's been a lot of attention drawn to ties between gun shows and the militia movement, which has put everyone on alert.
They realize they're coming under greater scrutiny. Right here, in fact, in Alameda County, the Board of Supervisors is looking to end the gun shows simply because of this atmosphere. I think what's going on now is that they're very sensitive to what they're doing and how they're doing it and who's watching them do it. And, of course, anytime you have, you know, press scrutiny, they're going to be even more sensitive. And right now, here's a security guy checking out, talking into his walkie-talkie.
How long are you going to be in here?
We paid our $6. We'll probably try to get our money's worth, I guess.
What kind of questions are you asking?
Just whatever comes to mind. Talking about guns, talking about selling of guns, the types of guns.
Just guns, guns, guns.
Yeah.
Why don't you talk some of the people about their coins, their jewelry, and, you know, antiques in here. So the public will know what's here so they can come down and look around.
But certainly the overwhelming majority of products sold here are guns.
Well, gun-related stuff, yes.
Well, and certainly there's more public concern about guns
and
than...
Probably there's probably been ATF through here already and undercover cops. So everything's done legal here. So I want that stressed to you.
Now, what is the concern with these gun trade shows?
Mm-hmm. The gun show laws vary from state to state, and historically, the gun shows have been a focal point for a lot of illegal sales and as a networking kind of opportunity for people in the firearm delivery system, in the gun selling industry. And so, in terms of what do the gun shows represent, they do represent a manifestation of the commerce of violence in the United States.
But concentrating on that commerce stream is going to be a difficult task when the gun lobby is pressuring lawmakers to target people who commit crimes instead of the firearms often used to perpetrate those crimes. You've heard the pro-gun slogan, guns don't kill people, people kill people. The most popular firearm is the handgun. One dealer here displays semi-automatic handguns and Colt revolvers, a Dirty Harry-type weapon with a polished silver snout and a six-shot barrel.
What would the process be if I wanted to purchase one of these handguns? Would I fill out a form? Do you have a form behind the
gun? Fill out two forms. Then it goes sent to the Department of Justice. They do a background check and also on the gun. And then you return in 20 days and we have the forms clearing the gun to release it to you. If it can't, you know, if it comes back, you're a felon or have problems in your background, then we just refund your money.
This dealer's not too happy about California's 20-day waiting period, but that could change if the state legislature passes a concealed weapons law.
I don't trust the government that won't trust a person to have a gun. If they put the carry law in effect, before you can get a carry permit, they do a complete background check with fingerprinting and everything. And then when you go in to buy a gun, you present your carry permit, and you phone that number in to the state with the number on the gun, and they've got a background check on the person that has the gun. When you call the gun in, you're trying to control an inanimate object, which will never happen, but under the carry permit, you're controlling the people who are allowed to buy guns. And most gun owners would go for that. But it'll never happen in the People's Republic of California.
According to the California Rifle and Pistol Association, about two dozen states have already enacted concealed carry laws, including Florida, Texas, and Arizona. Andreas Soto says fear of random crime has fueled both gun sales and the rush to pass laws allowing people to carry concealed weapons. And more women are packing heat these days. Due to declining gun sales in the 1980s, the National Rifle Association began targeting the female market, a previously untapped consumer base, and gun manufacturers tailored their weapons accordingly.
They started making them chrome, maybe putting the white pearlescent type of handles on them, handle grips on them, and marked them as an accessory to women under the Refuse to Be a Victim campaign. So we see some of that here as well. Those are mostly small, concealable type of handguns. Yeah.
Now, we were talking a little bit earlier about how these guns more often than not result in injury to the person or the person's family or family members, mm-hmm. and friends and whatnot. People enter the house rather than actually protecting that person.
Right.
What's the risk factor there?
The Kellerman studies that were printed in New England Journal of Medicine did comparative studies between various communities in the United States and Canada, and were able to show how a firearm is 43 times more likely to be used against a friend or a family member than it would ever be used in self-defense. And if you look at the study done by the Violence Policy Center relating to women and firearms, is that what you find is that for every time a woman has used a firearm in self-defense, and it's usually against the spouse or a boyfriend, that in fact 239 women are killed with firearms. And once again, mostly by their spouses or their boyfriends. In fact, one-third of all female homicides occur in the workplace, once again at the hands of their spouses or boyfriends.
Trying to hear what you're talking about, what kind of questions you're asking.
Why?
Well, because I'd like to know. I'm the children.
I don't see why you should be concerned.
We are.
Yes, I am.
Well, this is a public gathering,
it's
and we paid
public.
Our money, and
okay,
we're having a conversation.
Can I see your card, please?
Sure.
He's still recording, Mom.
Let's go take a copy of this so I know who...
Gun show owner Sally Nordyke and her son have interrupted my interview, demanding to see identification. She's protective of her turf for good reason. Two Bay Area counties have already banned gun shows on their fairgrounds, and Alameda County may do the same.
We abide by all the local, state, federal laws, and so I feel that we definitely are... a plus to the county.
A plus, says Nordyke, because her shows generate tax revenues for local municipalities. But whether gun shows abide by the law and generate money for the county, says Soto, is not the issue. He sees it from a public health perspective and says the circumstances behind the majority of gun-related deaths in the United States are staggering.
60% of all the people who die from guns are actually suicides. But it never gets reported because it's overwhelmingly older white males. And the media tends to view it as a privacy issue, whereas, you know, the media does focus on youth suicides as a great tragedy. You know, what's wrong with our kids? What have we done wrong? A whole lot of guilt on the part of communities as a whole, as well as individual families, when in fact teen suicides only make up 15% of the suicide picture. Annually, there's nearly 40,000 people who die every year. 60% of those are suicides. About 37% are homicides, and 3% are unintentional or justified shootings. And with both homicides and suicides, because those are acts of opportunities, the public health field is beginning to look at how can we restrict the role of handguns in these opportunistic environments.
But due to heavy pressure from the NRA, the ability to gather gun-related death and injury data could be in jeopardy. The National Center for Injury Prevention and Control, the nation's clearinghouse for such data, may be on the chopping block for next year's federal budget. The National Center for Injury Prevention and Control is a favorite target for some gun enthusiasts who see the center, the World Health Organization, and the United Nations working together in a conspiracy to take their guns away. Anti-UN slogans are found everywhere at this gun show, particularly on T-shirts being sold at one of the booths.
That's a common riff among these groups.
Mm-hmm.
The UN, Peace Through Terror.
Right, the UN is the New World Order, multi-government conspiracy, and that it's a belief amongst many of these folks that the UN is the vehicle by which worldwide gun control will be enacted.
The attendees at this gun show are almost entirely white. Soto, who's a Latino, stands out. In fact, we came across only one African-American dealer, and he was selling flint for survival kits. Nazi paraphernalia is readily available at the show. Overhead one of the booths, in the middle of the indoor auditorium, flies a swastika. And despite racist overtones, militia groups, says Soto, have captured the attention and, to a certain extent, respect of the government and mainstream media.
What we see in Montana with the Freeman really shows a whole new approach in dealing with extremist groups on the part of the federal government. And I think it's because of all the people who have been bought and sold in Congress by the NRA that they set up these Ruby Ridge and Waco hearings. And the result of that was is that the feds are now treating these kind of situations far differently than the way they handled the Black Panthers or the Brown Berets or the Young Lords back in the 60s, where they just basically went in and assassinated people. But the paranoia and the fear that I think these people are experiencing is that they are experiencing the same kind of alienation that we're seeing in with urban youth. You know, young African Americans, young Latinos, who, in the case of the cities, are directing their alienation, their anger, at the police, because that's who they're confronting. Whereas for these people, their fear is, you know, the federal government, and therefore then that's part of the one world government and the UN. So they're coming from the same place, but just manifesting it and outwardly directing it at a different target.
For Democracy Now!, I'm Philip Babbage in Oakland, California.
Next up, militia-connected congressmen. Stay with us. You're listening to Democracy Now!. I'm Amy Goodman. The influence of the militia movement is now being felt within the Republican Party. The 1994 election of Helen Chenoweth of Idaho and Steve Stockman of Texas to the U.S. Congress were just the beginning. Now a new crop is vying for power in this year's elections, and as Pacifica's Don Rush reports, they have a good chance of winning.
The Village Voice this month may have peeked into the Republican future, candidates strongly affiliated with the growing militia movement. They range from the upset victory by Ron Paul in the Republican Texas congressional primary to Charles Duke running for the Republican senatorial nomination in Colorado. Village Voice reporter Thomas Goetz.
They make no bones about being allied with militias. They call themselves patriots and will defend patriots and far-right issues, you know, willingly.
Mike Hammond is running for the Republican congressional nomination in New Hampshire. A co-chair of Pat Buchanan's presidential campaign, Hammond is a consultant for the Gun Owners of America, and he is strongly supported by Steve Scott of the White Mountain Militia Information Service. The Village Voice quotes Scott as saying his organization would do whatever it could to help the New Hampshire Republican. Hammond says he accepts such support.
These are, by and large, in most cases, a bunch of people who are very patriotic and very intent on doing what's right for their country. There's obviously a few exceptions, but I don't see the movement as general as being something threatening or ominous.
But the man who has taken the public spotlight is Colorado State Senator Charles Duke, who recently tried to negotiate an end to the Freeman standoff with the federal government. He's running for U.S. Senate. The Village Voice reports that Duke received honoraria totaling over $900 from two key militia organizers in 1995. It also notes that last year the Denver Post reported Duke's office kept in constant contact with militia leaders in Montana and New Hampshire, among others. Goetz says Duke's star has clearly risen within the ranks of the militia movement.
He's far more out there in terms of open affinities with the patriot movement. He's also been speaking with militias. As we saw in with the Freeman, he's becoming something of a figurehead along the lines of Bo Greitz.
Greitz, long affiliated with the right, negotiated the end of the standoff at Ruby Ridge. Down south, the most startling upset involved Ron Paul, who captured the Republican congressional nomination in Texas, despite strong opposition from the Republican establishment. He's described as an anti-United Nations pro-gun candidate who wants to return to the House as part of a new right vanguard. And in Missouri, there's John Moore, who actually commands the 1st Missouri Volunteers Militia. He's running against Minority Leader Dick Gephardt. Moore notes that members of his militia have also entered the Democratic and Libertarian congressional primaries, and he believes his militia allies played a key role in Missouri's presidential contest.
We took over the state Republican Party for one day during the Buchanan caucus, Republican caucuses in Missouri, and we made Buchanan a winner in the state Republican caucuses. We can't take full credit for it, and I wouldn't pretend to do that, but The militia people provided much of the work that was done to make Buchanan a winner in the state of Missouri about 2 months ago.
1994 saw the first of these militia-affiliated candidates, and their influence appears to be growing with other congressional members. Mike Hammond, running for the congressional seat in New Hampshire, describes the movement this way.
Many people believe that when the Constitution says in the 10th Amendment that the rights not delegated to the federal government are reserved to the states and the people, that the Constitution also means that we are a government of delegated rights, and those rights are laid out in Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution. And the whole notion that we are so wise that we can, at this stage of the game, second-guess the Founding Fathers and try to rewrite the document, which has served us so well for 200 years, I think a lot of people resist that notion in general.
In the shadows of the top Republican money machines, Village Voice reporter Thomas Goetz says there's a host of smaller conservative political action committees pouring money into these campaigns. For instance, he says, the Gun Owners of America solicits funds for far-right candidates ranging from Congresswoman Helen Chenoweth in Idaho to Republican challenger Mike Hammond in New Hampshire. The anti-abortion PACs are also pouring money into the campaigns of candidates like Moore and Paul. Village Voice reporter Thomas Goetz.
There's a PAC in Dallas called Government Is Not God, appropriately, and they don't fund a lot. They don't have a lot of money, but they do manage to pinpoint the. They don't waste what they have. They pinpoint exactly those candidates who are most in line with their beliefs.
And Goetz says the lasting impact of these candidacies, win or lose, will be the strengthening of the far right presence in national politics. Don Rush, Pacifica Network News, Washington.
And thank you for that, Don. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Earlier this month, presidential candidate Robert Dole called public housing the last bastion of socialism in America and called for an end to the nation's public housing projects. His comments came as Congress is considering a public housing reform measure that's received little national attention. One element of this bill would limit occupancy, a provision that has been used against poor families, immigrant families, and families of color who are more likely to live in an extended family situation. We're joined now by Ellen Pater, who is an anthropologist and professor of regional planning at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. She's currently a Rockefeller Fellow in Legal Humanities at Stanford. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Hello.
Hi. Last week, we did a piece on racism and housing in Philadelphia, and we thought this would be an interesting way to broaden the discussion and talk about this congressional legislation that very few people know about. What is the problem with a standard like this, with this issue of occupancy?
Well, it does sound seductive, doesn't it? The proposed standard seems to promise more home space to everybody, regardless of income. In reality, however, the implication is just the opposite. It limits opportunities for low and moderate income households to even find affordable housing, which in turn, of course, limits their opportunity to choose neighborhoods with good schools and services. I can give you some idea of how this would work and who'd be hurt by a two-person per bedroom occupancy limit. You can think of the family of five in which two people earn a minimum wage, or in which someone lost a job to downsizing, who just wanted to live in a two-bedroom home in a more expensive neighborhood with better schools. Each of them would be required to find the money for the additional third bedroom that would be required by this bill. And you can even think of the parents living in a one-bedroom apartment who could be given notice to move when they come home from the hospital with a one-day-old infant because they'd exceed the standard. And before you think I'm taking this to the level of the absurd with this example, this is already happening in apartments where owners are enforcing a two-person per bedroom standard. And even somewhat ironically, you mentioned Bob Dole. One of the stories that he uses to identify with working people is growing up with six people in a two-bedroom house. If this proposition had been in effect back then, his family might have even have been amongst the evicted. And to make matters worse, this bill is being proposed at a time when the number of families, as you alluded to, is actually increasing, the number who are living in two bedrooms, more than two bedrooms. So you can see this very seemingly small provision has quite far-ranging implications.
Who's behind the change in the law?
Well, not surprisingly, the people behind the change include some of the same legislators who are rallying around calls for self-sufficiency and the end to welfare. Well, they're proposing bills like this that would put obstacles in the way. It's sponsored by Republican Representative Bill McCollum from Florida, and it echoes a bill that was proposed in the Senate by Republicans Faircloth and Kyle. Interesting, John Kyle represents Arizona, a state which last year enacted a two-person per bedroom occupancy standard that's currently being contested by civil rights organizations. And both the bill and the legislative sponsors are backed by the Washington, D.C.-based National Multi-Housing Council, which is a lobbying organization of PAC, which represents the interests of property owners, managers, and developers, and by other rental industry organizations as well.
Professor Pater, you've examined the history of occupancy standards in some of your work. How have these standards been used in the past?
Well, this is really heir to a long history of trying to use the standards to get rid of unwanted populations. For instance, in the 1870s, prominent Californian citizens and politicians who were members of anti-Chinese organizations passed a restrictive occupancy standard that was primarily enforced in Chinatown. In the 1990s, examples include courts overturning attempts by the cities of Wildwood, New Jersey, and Santa Ana, California, to use restrictive occupancy standards against growing Latino communities. And there are currently cases against apartment owners for restricting access to families with children across the country. And, of course, the new law in Arizona seems to have both racial and family discrimination implications, particularly against the Mexican-American and Native American populations in that state.
Have there been public hearings? Has Congress held hearings? And have people like you testified?
To my knowledge, they haven't. There haven't been any hearings, especially against Section 508, which is the occupancy standard, which in fact seems to have been slipped into the public housing reform bill quite late.
Now, let me ask you again. We're talking with Professor Ellen Pater, who is a professor and anthropologist who's been looking at housing for many years now. How does the law work now? How is it written, and how does it work?
Well, at the moment, states have the rights to establish their own occupancy standards if they want. Generally, they're based on the number of people per square foot, which obviously is much more flexible than a blanket two people per bedroom, regardless of size or family composition. Many states adopt their standards from ones developed by the building industry, which are based on health and safety concerns for the occupants, as well as maintenance needs for the owner. The new law wouldn't allow health and safety to be the primary concern, and it would leave it to the rental industry to determine how many people they can manage and how much money they want to spend on upkeep.
Where do you think this bill is headed right now?
Well, I can only see it leading to more precariously housed and homeless families, which, of course, would necessitate spending more money on shelters and other services. What I find particularly insidious about this bill is that it would give rental housing industry the right to determine fundamental social policy, even though they're not elected officials. What I mean by this is that the bill gives the rental industry the legal right to decide where low and moderate income families can and cannot live. So even if a family has enough money to, for instance, for a two-bedroom apartment that suits their space needs and is in the community of their choice, the family can be denied the home because their family is too large to satisfy the restrictions that it would be legal for the rental industry to mandate. So even if just one of their bedrooms has three people or a living room has one or two people, a family can be prevented from living where they want to. In other words, the bill gives the rental industry the right to tell people that they have to give up their own money to them, the rental industry, instead of perhaps saving for a new home, giving a child music lessons, buying basic food, or just putting money in the bank. Severely limiting a family's housing opportunities like this will also lead to more racially segregated neighborhoods, which brings me to the Fair Housing Act, which makes it illegal to discriminate against people of color and families with children in rentals. And I think that this bill is trying to circumvent the Fair Housing Act because the occupancy standard that's being proposed as part of a public housing bill will primarily benefit the private rental industry. And I can't believe the sponsors don't know it'll have a disproportionate impact against these populations.
Dr. Pater, we only have a minute, but I want to ask if there's been any effective organizing against the public housing reform bill.
Well, I know some of the low-income housing organizations are organizing against it. The occupancy standard provision, however, is individual groups and individual people that are trying to organize against it. It's not as high up on the list for many people as the demolition of the public housing altogether, which this bill would have. So it is limited, and I hope some of the people listening will get involved, because it's really quite important.
Dr. Pater, we want to thank you very much for joining us. Dr. Ellen Pater, anthropologist and professor of regional planning at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. She's currently a Rockefeller Fellow in Legal Humanities at Stanford. Democracy Now! Is produced by Julie Drizin, with occasional mystery appearances throughout the show. Production help from Pats Greenfield and Egan. Our engineer is Matthew Finch, our director, Errol Maitland, and we'd love to hear from you. You can leave voicemail for us, and we'll play some of that mail on the air. You can call us at 202-588-0988, extension 313. That's 202-588-0988. Extension 313, or you can get a copy of the show by calling the Pacifica Archives at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Thanks to Grayson Challenger, who helped with engineering. I'm Amy Goodman. Join us tomorrow. We'll be looking at HMO abuse on another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!